Hello and welcome. You are now listening to 3CR Community Radio's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day broadcast for 2026. I am your host, Amy Ciara. I would like to start today's program by acknowledging that this broadcast is coming to you today from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nations. Sovereignty was never ceded, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and to extend that respects to any First Nations listeners tuning in today. I would also like to acknowledge a very dear and special elder, Uncle Taljum Choco Edwards, for giving up his time slot in order for us to do this broadcast. I recommend you listen to his show, Balamoir, and buy his book from the 3CR shop. We cannot talk about complex trauma without acknowledging the damage of genocide done to generations of First Nations people since invasion. Uncle Taljum's story is one of a lot of adversity as a stolen gen in the colony, and one of courage, laughs, cheekiness, and resistance in the face of it. Thanks, Unc. Today's conversations is about complex trauma and dissociative disorders. Catch last year's broadcast at 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2025 or head to the Blue Knot Foundation website at blueknot.org.au to learn more about dissociative disorders and complex trauma. But a quick refresher. Complex trauma refers to cumulative, underlying, and often interpersonal trauma, commonly from childhood. It often but not always occurs when the child victim is trapped and under the control and domination of the perpetrator. Dissociation is a spectrum that we all experience, but on the severe end of the spectrum are what is called dissociative disorders. Dissociation and or dissociative disorders are often part of the fallout from complex trauma. This year's theme is navigating medical systems. Complex trauma and dissociative disorders come with an immense amount of misunderstanding and stigma. The most famous example is dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder, which is often stigmatized in media and presented as dangerous. Fair warning, today's content will likely contain many potentially triggering topics and you may find yourself in need of support. If you do, I recommend one of the following numbers. Lifeline at 13 11 14, Suicide Callback Service at 1300 659 467. If you're First Nations, 13YARN at 13 92 76. If you're part of the LGBT plus community, I recommend Rainbow Door at 1800 729 367. And of course, the Blue Knot Foundation's number is 1300 657 380. Countering the stigma and challenges we often find in medical systems, in today's episode, we start with an interview with the president of the Blue Knot Foundation and returning guest, Kathy Kesselman. Then we will be chatting to other people living with complex trauma and DID on their personal experiences navigating medical systems. I will be sharing my own personal experiences of these systems too along the way. Yes, that's right, I am a person with dissociative identity disorder. And that means that I, Amy, share this head with a collection of different alters, headmates, dissociative self states, whatever you want to call them. Which means sometimes it's more appropriate to refer to ourselves in a plural way, such as we, ours, and us. There is a lot to learn and understand if you're new to this, and I think there is no better person to start with than Kathy. So let's go to that interview.
Yeah, so my name's Kathy. I'm president of Blue Knot Foundation. And we're an organisation that works with people who've had experiences of complex trauma. So repeated abuse, neglect, violence, you know, often as a child, but not always. And what we know is that people who are impacted by complex trauma often experience dissociation as part of the mechanism for coping with the potential for being overwhelmed. I'm also a survivor of my own story and my own experiences, and I also have had my own experiences of dissociation over a long period of time.
Thank you. And so we're talking medical systems this year at 3CR, and how does Blue Knot and your places in advocacy help shape the medical community's understanding of what complex trauma and dissociation are?
Look, I think this is absolutely a work in progress.
Yeah.
And interestingly, we're currently working with the Medical Journal of Australia, and we've had a couple of articles in recently around complex trauma and a podcast. We're also starting to talk to them about dissociation. But what we know is that even in with counsellors and psychologists and psychiatrists, let alone, you know, GPs and other medical practitioners, there's been a real lack of understanding around complex trauma and dissociation, and particularly the needs of people who are, you know, grappling with it, with its impacts. And I think there's been certainly a lot of misinformation, a lot of stigma, and a real, therefore, you know, treatments that really aren't supportive at times and can actually make it worse.
All the people I've interviewed so far, including myself, have had experiences of navigating medical systems and sharing either something going on with us, specifically around dissociative identity disorder, and the first response is to check whether that person that we're talking to is safe, that the medical professional feels unsafe, that we might be violent or dangerous.
Yes, and that's a common misconception, of course, and we know that people who, you know, are, you know, and DID is at the extreme end of the dissociative spectrum, are much more likely, well, we know, have been harmed in a very significant way and way less likely to be, you know, be a danger to others. It's really about, you know, what's happened to you and to others. To have impacted you so profoundly that your mind had to be really creative and, you know, compartmentalize your experiences and your memory and your thoughts and your feelings and create parts of yourself. And that's, you know, quite a ingenious protective mechanism. But it's been sensationalized, it's been questioned, it's been disbelieved, and what happens is that people such as yourself are negated for your very, you know, for your survival mechanisms, and that's just incredibly damaging and re-traumatizing, as you know only too well.
And so one of my one of the other people I interviewed raised a good point, which was they went in for surgeries to do with a different condition. And what happened was they warned the staff that there's a chance that someone else might wake up from the surgery. And no one in the staff made note of that. And so they had a very distressing experience. The staff felt unsafe. It was quite a mess. So something that I hadn't considered for this broadcast is it doesn't have to just be the mental health community. It has to be the whole medical community to have some understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we now have, you know, because doctors are trained in science and evidence, we have actually quite substantial evidence now around, you know, the basis of dissociation and DID, including, you know, functional MRIs and all sorts of sophisticated ways of showing that this is actually not only a brain mechanism, but that it responds to, you know, to often relational-based treatments and the first cab off the rank around that is feeling safe and grounded, you know, and that's just so important, and the importance of that cannot be minimised.
On that greater understanding, I'm navigating a public health system this year and getting some extra supports. And they offer some trauma, which is wonderful, like trauma tools and courses, including dialectical behavioral therapy. And my therapist said to me that DBT is sort of the gold standard for borderline personality disorder, but it will have useful tools for me, but not everything will be useful. And one of my potential guests for this broadcast has talked about how they've done DBT and found some things useful, but it was entirely catered to people who are singular.
I mean, it's challenging, and the whole diagnosis of borderline personality disorder is another conversation in itself. And we know that, you know, these diagnostic criteria, you know, have some value, but, you know, what's way more important is the person and, you know, how they're presenting and what's happened to them and how it's impacted them and how they've survived. So, you know, we can use a label, but then, you know, how do we respond to someone that we, you know, that practitioners are working with? So, yes, you know, different modalities and tools, but there's no single modality for anything. It's around, you know, having a whole toolkit.
Yeah.
And bringing to the relationship, you know, what's, you know, particularly useful at the time. And we know the most useful thing is the relationship.
Which I suppose is that thing that I've been mindful of in my interviews this year, which is the medical community needs labels, it needs these tools, but we are more than that. I'm a jigsaw puzzle. Part of that is DID, you know.
we're human beings. We're complex. And I suppose DID, you know, is complex, but it's also quite easy to understand. And, you know, it's actually, you know, quite a remarkable way that people survive, you know, by, you know, basically biting off trauma into, you know, bite-sized chunks so that it doesn't overwhelm, you know. And I think, I don't know, to be honest, I really struggle with why it's been so hard to understand. I think probably because there's so many myths about it, and because it has been sensationalized in media and in film and in portrayal. And until now, we've not had the scientific evidence around it, because any trials that were done with people with DID excluded just about everyone with DID. So now we actually, you know, Bethany Brand, is professor in Tucson, is absolutely a leader in this area. And, you know, the medical fraternity likes, you know, randomized controlled trials, and she's got a very, very sophisticated one and a very solid program, which is just showing remarkable responses.
Sticking to, you were mentioning MRI scans and that our understanding is getting better. I also know that I saw an article in researching for this show. There was a study that said 42% of Australians have suffered some significant trauma as children. We also know that there was the ACEs test developed a while ago, which said that people with a certain amount of trauma in their childhoods are likely to have very high increased risks of all kinds of illnesses and to live on average 20 years less than their age group. And that, well, I know that they vary a lot, but it seems like that people living with complex trauma and DID and other dissociative disorders are a significant portion of the population. Is complex trauma and dissociation a health epidemic that needs to be talked about more?
Look, I don't know if I'd call it about a health epidemic. It definitely needs to be talked about more. It definitely needs to be understood more. It's highly prevalent. It's often not identified. It's the particular challenges for people who have experienced it and not understood, and therefore people get bounced around the system without finding the support they need, and that's just not okay. So it is a public health issue, I believe, major public health issue, and it requires a lot more education and a lot more understanding and a compassionate response rather than a stigmatized, judgmental one.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day broadcast. You are listening to a conversation between myself, Amy, with Kathy Kesselman, president of the Blue Knot Foundation. We now return to that interview. One of the things that I've included in my conversations with other people like myself is structural supports. So I think that it's not simply just that we need informed medical professionals. No. We need secure housing. We need to have a secure income. This last year, I sort of hit a point where I needed to take a good break from work. And on Centrelink, looking at the DSP, which is quite scary because of how Centrelink functions. And that's something
another,
I've always...
That's another episode.
Yeah. and I think, well, funny thing is like the... I think one of the simple things that we could use people with complex trauma is something in the Medicare rebates to help us. I've seen that some health issues for seeing a therapist are like I think anorexia nervosa can get extra, at least in New South Wales, can get extra sessions with a therapist under the Medicare rebate. And I think the nature of complex trauma and dissociative disorders requires a lot of therapy. And that's probably an area of reform that probably could benefit a lot of people.
Yeah, it was interesting around the time that the Royal Commission Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse occurred and the redress scheme and all everything else that came out of it. People were talking about a gold card for people who'd had that, you know, a bit like a veteran's card, you know, whereby it's, you know, your trauma is recognised. And the response that you can receive is commensurate with the trauma and its impacts. So absolutely, you know, all of the supports around daily life that, you know, many other people take for granted, you know, it's and you know, a therapeutic approach is not necessarily the first cab off the rank for a whole pile of people. So there's so many other supports, you know, just to even get to the point of being safe enough to reach out to seek help. To actually, you know, and sort of psychoeducation to actually understand that this is not your fault. You're not a failure. In fact, you know, you've got a remarkable mind. And to understand that can make such a big difference. But all of that, I agree. I don't know what the mechanism is, but it's about recognition about the, you know, the complexity of need as well.
Yeah, because I and I know other people have done the process of getting a victim's claim, which is quite another episode in itself, because it is a very long and difficult process that requires, for people who don't know, it requires some form of police reporting. And I had the experience of going into the station to – oh, sorry, am I cutting out for you?
No. It's okay, like you're freezing. I can hear your voice.
Okay, yeah. I had the experience of going into the police station and having to, the way that they take the information is asking you what time did it happen, what was the date, and it's extremely difficult to recall something that happened regularly as a child that you were dissociating through, and how are you as a child supposed to keep track of the dates and times it was happening to you?
Particularly when you are living with DID, which by its definition is about, you know, breaking the connections between things, and, you know, where chronology is, I mean, I struggle with chronology and my memory, you know, you know, still, you know, I don't, you know, don't sort of lay down details of chronology. And, you know, this is a big part of education in the legal and justice system, you know, to actually understand, you know, why victims may seem like they're unreliable witnesses, you know, because that's the nature of traumatic memory, the nature of traumatic amnesia and fragmented memory, and you know, and you know, that's a big education piece as well. You know, it's I don't know if you've, you know, followed the story of Jenny Haynes, who was the first person with DID to have parts give evidence in court.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And for her evidence to be upheld and for a conviction to be reached on the first person globally, and she's in Australia. So first person globally for that to happen and that evidence to be taken, you know, which is quite, and, you know, that's an absolute acknowledgement that, yeah, we get it. This is what you've, you know, you've had to do to survive, and all of these parts that are coming are telling us something, you know, so we need to listen.
And just hearing that story makes me exhausted, because that's an incredible amount of labor for Jenny to do.
Oh, yes. I mean, that, you know, they, yeah, they've had a very, very long, arduous path, but great determination and passion and, you know, and celebration now with the outcome, and also quite remarkable support from the police, you know, which was fantastic. It's not always the case either, again, because of lack of knowledge and understanding. Yeah.
I would encourage anyone listening to this broadcast to attempt or look into pursuing the victim's claim if you think you're entitled to it, despite how challenging it is. Mm. You don't actually need a conviction to get the claim. And it's something that is, even though maybe it's not enough for the way trauma is ongoing, it's something that can really help.
Yeah.
It actually stopped me from being homeless.
Yeah, they're all pieces of the puzzle, aren't they?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, that's another thing about the system. We're talking about fragmentation. The system's so fragmented.
Yeah.
And when you have, you know, someone such as yourself who has been able to navigate it, but not easily, there are so many people who can't navigate it because the system is so complex. And, you know, medical practitioners and therapists find it hard to navigate the system as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's, unless you know the ins and outs, it's very, very challenging, and often people give up.
Can I also ask you, just jumping back a bit, the other thing that I've experienced is medical practitioners not understanding the difference between having alters and having them inside my head, and in schizophrenia. I've had people initially give me hearing voices information or hearing voices groups, and I try to explain that it's not that. And I've met someone else who's also had the same experience now.
I think that's very common. It's often misdiagnosed as being psychotic, but your voices are internal, and the main difference, there's a lot of differences, but you're in touch with reality. You know, people who are psychotic are not in touch with reality. Your reality is presented in different parts by different voices, but it's a collective reality. Yeah.
Mm. So what is Blue Knot offers a lot of different services, and they also give education to the medical community, and there probably will be people from the medical community listening. Sort of education does Blue Knot Foundation provide?
Oh, look, obviously we've got a lot of resources, a lot of information on our website, but we also run professional development sessions. We've got a whole day training around dissociation, Association, DID, trainings around complex trauma, trauma-informed practice. We've got publications specifically for practitioners as well. Mm. So it's just a, you know, wealth of information on, you know, both our community site and our professional site. So if you drill into that. And also a lot of, you know, guidelines which articulate the evidence base around complex trauma and dissociation, including a set of guidelines specifically around dissociation.
And so what's the feedback you get from people taking these education materials? Are people having their eyes opened?
Absolutely. Aha moments, and, you know, now that makes sense. You know, it actually closes the loop on you know, people who have observed things and, you know, just look, we all like to explain and understand things. And I think, understanding why people get triggered and why, you know, people may appear to change mood in front of you or, you know, not be present or shut down or with, you know, there's all, you know, understanding is incredibly helpful. And having physiological explanations for that as well, you know, that it's not the person's fault, but there's a biology here that is an imperative that's helped people to survive. I think that's, and for the medical profession, that's the basis of, you know, of understanding. It's important.
And what does Blue Knot hear from people living with complex trauma and DID? Are there some common, like you've mentioned that you've got some common stories that I've already mentioned. What's the community living with these things telling Blue Knot?
Very much akin to what you're saying, that, you know, it's really hard to find services that are adequate, connected, informed, understanding, compassionate for the long term. Not to say that there aren't some, you know, well-educated, amazing practitioners out there, but they're also working within a system that, as you say, doesn't have a special Medicare rebate for the requirements of someone with really complex needs.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's fairly consistent that, you know, people struggle with labels, struggle with ignorance, struggle with the myths, and I think another element is also having to prove that you're a victim. You know, this sort of, you know, constant requirement to support your own experience. You know, when you're struggling with your experience and its impact is just so offensive. Yeah.
And also it's something common for lots of people I've spoken to of complex trauma to doubt what happened to you, because gaslighting is something we experienced a lot. And also when it's dissociative, is, am I making this up? Am I crazy? Like those sorts of feelings. Yeah,
absolutely. And I certainly remember that experience myself when I first became aware I was dissociating. I thought, yeah, I mean, I thought I was crazy. I didn't understand. I really questioned myself. When you've got a society that's questioning you as well, and you're sort of experiencing things that are outside of your experience, which is such a weird, as we know, that's part of the whole. Yeah, that's very challenging, you know, because you can't articulate, and you can't articulate to others. So, you know, how do others respond as well?
And isolating. That's the other thing that I think. Living with this can be incredibly isolating, and the people I've spoken to, one of the things we all share is how we've had, one of the things that's helped us survive is finding community. So I have found community in this radio station, but also in a local LGBT plus group that just meets up socially, and one of my interviewees is from that group. Particularly in that space, because there's a lot of neurodivergence and mental health in our community, it's extremely accepting.
exactly. And that's the thing I think about finding a community. You don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to, you know, feel that, you're an alien or you're being judged. You know, you just fit, you know, and it's really hard when you have really struggled to fit. And so, you know, a peer community, whatever the nature of the peers is, if it's something that resonates with you and you resonate with them, is just, you know, can't be replaced. It can't be, you know, it's just invaluable.
And I think things like that, actually are part of the model for healing. It's absolutely. Not just it's going to see a therapist.
Absolutely. Support networks are absolutely crucial. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot of other things, you know, people find, you know, journaling very helpful, you know, grounding strategies, you know, self-care, you know, all of the other elements. So it's not just a one-stop shop and you know, different modalities and different approaches support different people. It's about individuals. We're all individuals. Yeah.
The other thing that I've included in our conversations as that support is rest. Since we've stopped working, we'll do like a day or two at the radio station. And we're also working on ourselves and the exhaustion. Days or even a week of just exhaustion. That I think is something people need to understand as well. Because Amy, am like the face of this little organization in here. We mask in a similar way to autistic people. So that masking is constantly people in our lives think Amy's really put together. Amy's going great. But then Amy goes home and Amy's something else and exhausted.
I remember when I was, in the midst of this coming out, I'd go to see my therapist and I would barely make it back to my car and I'd literally pass out in the car. You know, it's just the exhaustion of that experience, the reliving, and as you say, trying to manage all of, that marketplace in your head and engage in a society that doesn't get it. I think it is exhausting. And, everyone talks about, get plenty of rest and sleep and eat well and, all of that. It's very trite and it's really hard to do.
And that's actually how, where medical systems, I think, need to understand this, because I'm also doing that masking when I engage with them for the first time. So I'm aware that I have to sort of, I have this thing and I need help. Professional. And then I realize that from their questions that they don't fully understand it. So then I'll say something like, okay, well, right now I have an elder who embodies all our rage and she's under control. We've got that stable, but she's having an intrusive thought right now where she wants to punch the wall or she wants to do this and she's really angry. And then of course their first fear is there, are they safe?
That's right.
And then also recently someone followed that up with maybe I should go to a psychiatric ward. And that's not something that we felt like we needed, or my therapist we needed.
And the reality is you're probably better informed than the person you're talking to, because you have a very high degree of understanding of yourself and what's gone on and but not everyone does either, I don't know if that's better or, it just is, I suppose.
And I think that we are so good at hiding things that's another thing that probably people need to understand if they're working with us, is that we're not even aware of some of the things we're hiding.
Well, that's right. There's what you know and then what you discover along the way. And then how you may begin to connect it up.
And I think the theme that's really come through in my conversations is safe space. When you're doing the therapy, when you're trying to get help, you need a safe space, and that safe space needs to be accepting, and it needs to mostly just listen, I think. Thank you so much, Kathy. I think we've got plenty.
That's been terrific. Thank you. Nice to see you again.
I thought we could also let people know about the services. I believe you have a phone service. I used it once about a year ago. I spoke to a trauma-informed counsellor. Could run through some services for people with complex trauma.
We run a helpline. So the number for that is 1-300-657-380, and that operates 9 to 5, 7 days a week. We also support people going through the National Redress Scheme, so people who've experienced institutional child sexual abuse. We have workshops for survivors as well as for family members. Websites blueknot.org.au, lots of resources, videos, fact sheets. And then there's education and training and supervision reflective practitioners. So there's a lot of information there and resources.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Days broadcast. You've just heard an interview with Kathy Kelsman, of the Blue Knot Foundation. We now turn to interviews with other people living with DID and myself discussing our personal experiences of medical systems. I recommend checking out 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026 to listen to the complete versions of these interviews. They are wonderfully abundant with insight and experience. We will now turn to the first conversation between myself and Jack.
Hi, I'm Jack. I live in East Gippsland in Victoria, and the truth is that it's really hard to introduce myself because we've only been fairly recently diagnosed with DID. We're only fairly recently aware of all of this. So I've lived most of my life with almost like a half self or a pretend persona that we all kind of unknowingly took on to present a seamless or an apparently seamless self to the rest of the world and to ourselves, so that we didn't know we had DID. So it's actually at the moment a process of, I'm kind of in the very beginning stages of a process of trying to get to know my own self. So I guess what I know about myself is that I love to read, I love to write, I love language. And everything feels pretty new.
Yeah, that's lovely. And I think that's like perfectly fine. And like, I think the common story for DID is that most people don't realize it until they're an adult. I didn't realize it till I was 25, I think. I'm 30 now. Generally there's like an event in life. It's not always the case for everyone, but usually there's a very challenging event in life that leads to a bit of an unraveling that starts to make an awareness of the DID. And that's what we talked about last year. And I think everyone's at their different like places and understandings with it. And I guess one of the things that what you just said made me think about is that it can be quite an existentially confronting thing to start to realize this, what's going on, what's happening in the mind with this stuff and identity and all that.
Exactly. For us, like, that's one of the things that's been really challenging and that we, you know, comes up over and over again in therapy. You know, if you think about it, like, a lot of movies and TV shows that are going for an aspect of like existential horror will use this kind of setup where suddenly a person's confronted by the fact that there's stuff going on in their mind and that their identity isn't what they thought it was and their whole world falls apart. Like, I think Star Trek did it multiple times with different characters being cloned, and what does that mean that there's two of me, or, you know, or finding out that they have some alien whatever living within their, you know, shared experience within. And it's like this, there's this recurring theme in fiction around the existential horror of not knowing oneself. And for us, that was and has been and continues to be an enormous struggle on top of everything else. It's like, I guess because most people can, you know, can confidently say they know themselves. And we've been dragged into a place where we have to acknowledge that we don't know ourselves. Like, you know, sometimes I've had somebody, you know, if I've been in a bit of conflict with somebody, not intense, but a little bit of conflict, and there's a discussion about, well, you said this, and they'll say, I didn't say that. I don't remember the conversation, but I know I didn't say that because that's not something I would say. I know that that's not something I would say. And like, for us, it's like, we feel like that even that certainty has been taken away. Like, I might know that I wouldn't say that, but maybe one of us did. You know, it's, anyway, it's challenging.
Yeah. And then it's also, it changes the dynamics in your relationships. It's quite like on a relational level with other people in your life, it makes it all quite new territory, and I've talked with other people who are quite similar to myself and my cohort of people in my head, that there's a lot of masking and work we do to just try and sort of make it easier with other people. But there is, how has it affected your relationships in life?
Well, actually, the crisis, it wasn't a crisis event, but we're also autistic, and like many autistic people who are undiagnosed, and even actually a lot of diagnosed autistic people, we hit around 45, kind of hit that intense autistic burnout and suddenly just could not function at all. And basically dropped everything in our lives. And so I guess the result of that was, like, that lasted, well, we're only just coming out of it now, so 6 or 7 years. And through that process, actually, we just don't really have people in our life. And then we've moved to the country from the city alone. And so I guess I don't know what it would have done to existing relationships, but I know that it makes forming new relationships quite challenging. Even though we're fully open about having DID and being autistic, so there's never any ambiguity around people not understanding what's going on, but they don't get it. Like, you can tell somebody something, that doesn't mean they understand it.
Both those things come with an immense amount of myths and stigma, autism and DID.
Yeah, absolutely. I was at a writing retreat on the weekend, and a situation arose where I ended up telling the 8 or 9 people I was sitting with that I have DID. And, well, actually, it was a different one of us. But anyway, she told them about it. It was Beatrice. And she told them about it. And somebody said something about, you know, like it was received really well. But someone said something about, and of course, it's nothing like the stereotypes you see on TV and stuff. And I said, yeah, there is no serial killer. You're safe. I'm not going to kill you. And somebody jokingly said, yes, but that's exactly what the serial killer would say, right? You know, so it was good that they could joke about it and that there was that awareness because of the particular group it was. But certainly other people that I've told, they've said, like, oh, is that like, and they'll name a movie that's like horrific representation. Yes and no. It's nothing like that.
And so this year's theme is navigating medical systems. I'm just curious, as a person with autism or as an autistic person, I'm not sure which way around you prefer that. I know autistic person. As an autistic person, do you find, have you already been engaged with medical services or therapeutic supports?
I guess the largest engagement we've had was the actual diagnosis process for both things. And so we started seeing a therapist 3 years ago who's a clinical social worker. And she very quickly recognized that we had DID, even though we didn't know, because she's very skilled at it and she, you know, works with it. And then over a 6-month period, she also began to question whether we were autistic.
Right, yeah.
And both of those things we fought her tooth and nail on, just insisting she was wrong.
Can I ask why?
Well, we didn't have the classic, you know, like when you read the DSM about DID, we didn't, like, we don't experience daily amnesia around, like, we never have the experience of, I don't remember putting that there, or where did this go, or any of those things. Like, when we did the dissociation, whatever scale thing it is, we didn't really register as having significant dissociation. And that's possibly, again, like there's this overlap between dissociation and autism, like trauma and autism. So I think both things were masking each other because we also don't have a lot of stereotypical autistic traits, or at least we didn't know that we did at the time, because we were masking very strongly. So eventually the therapist arranged for us to have, you know, with our consent, of course, to see a psychiatrist to get formal diagnoses of both those things once. Well, for us, we were thinking we were going there to prove her wrong. but we agreed that, you know, we'd go and just find out. We'd ask someone else what they thought. and the psychiatrist was very bad. He had no experience of autism at all. And no insight into the way that that assessment process might be affected by DID, because he accepted straight away that we have DID. Apparently it's very clear to everybody else. but then he gave us an assessment for autism that assumed that there was one person doing it, one identity doing it. So, you know, like it said things like, do you have problem, you know, do you find this, do you find it difficult when something can't be done the way that you thought it was going to be done? And the answer for that is different for all of us. I mean, some of us are 5 years old, some of us are 3 years old, some of us are, like, I'm 16, some are 23. It's like, you know, it's not a question that none of the questions on the assessment had an easy, straightforward answer, given the dissociation and the multiple selves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was just very disheartening. And so he decided we weren't autistic because we didn't get the right number on his little tick sheet. so then our therapist arranged for us to see a psychologist who is herself autistic. And she was very aware of dissociation in general and trauma stuff. But had, I think, no experience of working with people with DID, or maybe one time, I can't remember. But she was absolutely fantastic. Like right from the beginning, she just said, like, you take the lead in terms of what terminology I should use. Tell me what I'm getting wrong. Tell me what I'm missing. And we had 3 appointments with her, and she was so respectful and so intelligent around, like, thinking into what might be different for someone with DID who's autistic than for non-DID people who are autistic. And so she decided quite decisively that, yes, we're autistic and have ADHD. So that was a really positive process, I guess.
Disabled people are worth every bloody penny. I'm okay with spending money on the supports that we need.
There's more than 400,000 people who should be on the DSP, but are on JobSeeker instead.
I've got a life to live. I've got commitment, like everybody else in society.
The only way to provide meaningful support is stronger grassroots movements. These institutions are never going to be our saviour.
If everyone was the same, it would be a boring old world we live in.
We need to do a lot of work in this country around shifting community attitudes towards people that don't fit the white, able, straight, cisgendered person.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Welcome back to 3CR's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Days broadcast. We are listening to personal stories of navigating medical systems with complex trauma and dissociative identity disorder. We are now going to hear an interview I did with Kay.
My name is Kay. I'm 28 and I am a multiple person.
How long have you known?
How long have I known? I think I was told about it in 2020 and I accepted it in 2021.
And that's a pretty common story. Was it with a therapist?
Yes. Yeah. Clinical psych.
Yeah. And do you still see that psych?
Yeah, I do. I haven't seen him this year yet, busy year.
Yeah. And has your experience been good?
Psychology? Yeah. I think I got lucky in the end there. I will say that I was in multiple different kinds of therapy for years and years and years before that. I even tried equine therapy at one point.
Yep.
The horses did not cure me. I found that once I got my diagnosis and I was working on the right stuff, that I have improved in the ways that I've been trying to. There was a lot of financial flexibility. I was under a victims of crime payment plan for my sessions, but
those are limited, I think, aren't they? Because I've been on one too, and
they are. I was lucky enough to have my psych, who advocated for me in every way possible, who made it made space for me to feel any type of way I felt about the diagnosis as well. Like, I wasn't particularly happy about it. I kind of pushed back, but he just took care of me, I guess. I was lucky enough that he had some experience with DID before I found him. And when I was diagnosed, he let me figure that out as it came. But definitely felt like I could come to him with anything. There was no... In the past, I've had trouble, obviously, explaining things from the perception of just one person.
Yeah.
But with Adam, my psych, as soon as I met him, he was using language that made my brain feel included in the conversation. Referring to us as a collective, asking specifically what each individual part felt about even the smallest things. and remembering that certain parts aren't comfortable with certain questions or things, and just staying on top of that. Really excellent at it.
I've found, I feel like I'm the face of the group, the manager of things, but it's really a we. Lara picks up, my therapist, Lara, she picks up the facial expressions and what's going on, because it's quite visible when we're dissociating or struggling with who's in the driver's seat. And she's gotten to the point now where she can sort of guess who is coming up. And particularly like if it's like, certain feelings. And it's interesting that I think we have a similar, we've talked before, and we have similar DID where we're more covert than overt, which is most people's DID.
I mean, we're not even really supposed to know we have DID.
Yeah.
Our brain is supposed to be a little better at hiding it from us than it is. But covert is, just like overt, it's lots of different people experience it different way, and doesn't make any of it less or more valid.
But I think the fact that there's a space and room for us in therapy to do that means there's safety there with that therapist, and that the therapist's done something right. Your therapist and mine are clearly doing something right.
Yes.
And so what are some of the things that make you and your headmates, I like the term headmates, I don't know how you feel about that term, but how your headmates feel about safety? What makes you feel safe in therapy?
That's a good question. Ultimately, switching and being in the presence of other people while switching has never been comfortable. Not even in therapy. My brain really wants to protect itself from this diagnosis. So I think ultimately, like you said, a sign of me being comfortable is if a part is feeling comfy enough to make themselves known, or even just express an opinion without totally switching. The more little things like that that happen, the more comfortable we are outside of therapy, just living as a system, taking care of each other, staying in communication, making choices together rather than dealing with aftermath. I think the main thing is probably just consistency. Consistency is a safe feeling. I liked with my therapist going in and being allowed to sit down and say everything is fine, nothing is wrong, and then 20 minutes later actually have a part that wants to talk about what's going on. But for that moment of like being allowed to have everything be okay, even if it's masking, having the patience for that has always made me feel really safe.
And I think also something we've found is not being pushed. I think some therapies that we've experienced try to push people to come out, which was very distressing and destabilizing. And sometimes my therapist has maybe pushed a little too hard, and we've reflected on that, and it's a difficult landscape to navigate. But you're talking about comfort, and something that we have is that I and some other alters are not comfortable with everyone in our head. And I think something with DID is it's a whole new existential thing to confront, the dissociative amnesia and all that.
The worst thing about it is that it's not just whoever is the host or whatever that needs to confront that. It's every single part eventually needs to come to terms with the idea that they are one part of a whole. And that can be, some parts really don't like to hear it. Other parts totally get it, but they have no emotional connection to it. It can be different for everyone. But yeah, having this safe space to even just not switch is honestly nice. It also avoids me having headaches after therapy all the time.
We get headaches too. What else supports people with complex trauma and dissociative disorders is structural supports. So broadly in your life, what are some of the things that help facilitate you to do the therapeutic work, but also to just look after yourselves and everything? Like, what kind of structural supports have you felt have been useful? Did the victim's claim help with any of that? Obviously, therapy is expensive. And we also live in a housing crisis and a cost of living crisis and a climate crisis.
All of those crises. I was homeless when I had my diagnosis. And I was in temporary housing through contact through Barwon Health. And it had been my maybe third or fourth temporary situation in a few years. So if I didn't have that temporary situation, I would not have been eligible for community housing, which I now have. And I would not have had a safe space to exist it was still tough at the time while I was getting the diagnosis because it wasn't a safe space. But definitely the housing situation was a struggle. And it would have been so much worse me trying to figure out my... I don't think I would have, honestly. I don't think I would have tried to get diagnosed or tried to understand what was going on with me if I didn't have that space to sort of stand on. I needed stability before I could ask those questions. So that's why it took so long for me.
You need to focus on survival and protecting yourself.
Yeah, I was also really not well. Before my diagnosis, as I was a very, very sick, sad person.
Yeah, we were also.
I am a non-binary agender thing.
So,
I like they, them pronouns because it works both for my gender and multiplicity.
Yeah, I think that being in the gender sex spectrum of things, there's no reason why that should DID should question any of that.
No.
But I also think it also makes a lot of sense why people with DID would identify with it as well, because we're not experiencing gender or sex in a way that is coherent with the constructs of those two things, of the binary and,
It is incredibly different. I have parts that feel very strongly that they are cis men or cis women.
Mm-hmm.
I have parts that, like me, don't align with gender.
Yeah.
There's a lot of experience going on. Same with sexuality as well. There's a lot of different experiences going on in here. But this is sort of why I feel that some of it is very, like, a lot of that is very valid. But the body wishes to be perceived as a gay, non-binary person.
And the reason I brought up the DSM and that particular thing of identity confusion is because that is something weaponized. That is something that people say to queer and trans people. You're just confused. And so that was one of the things when I started learning about it at the beginning. I didn't like that because I fought really hard and we're very happy in this femme body and this femme way of being. We are happy with it. We don't fully identify with the gender binary, but we're happy with it. And we don't need that to be questioned because we're comfortable with that. Everyone in the system, in the head agrees. Like, this is what we wanted to be. Not everyone in my head is a girl or a woman, but it doesn't matter because this is what we wanted and what we fought for and we're happy with it.
And it's worth making the distinction between that and gender fluidity because it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Yeah.
It is, ultimately someone's gender expression is still their own to do something with. And that, when you're in a system, means that it's a collective that has agreed on what this expression is.
And we've had the experience outside of our therapist in those more like public systems where we got a lot of different people trying to help us. And also we were going through a rough time. Focus on our transness as trying to evaluate our mental health, like ask a lot of questions about it. And we'd say, no, like, look, honestly, like, yes, we're fine. We're happy with all this. Like, stop asking questions about this. Like, but I guess because they're not experienced with trans people, but I think for people who don't have a lot of experience with both queer and trans people, gender diverse, sex diverse people, and DID, it can make sense to us that that they would maybe equate the two things, like, and in a way that's not helpful.
This is coming from the experience of someone who only has one person in their brain.
Yeah.
So they only need to worry about one specific thing.
And I think if they are at all linked, it's not a bad thing. So it's just sort of interesting and really happy to hear that you have a therapist that is like accepting of everything, which is so good.
So
continuing on the theme of structural supports, What have been things that outside of therapy that have been really valuable? We know each other through a local community group, Geelong Rainbow.
Geelong Rainbow.
Yeah.
Those are my people. Geelong Rainbow is a non-for-profit community group that puts on queer events every month. We do coffee mornings. Basically, it's just a place to go to be with other queer people in Geelong. And a safe place. I love being on the committee. I'm the design officer, which basically means I get to draw gay people all day. And I was doing that anyway. Yeah. So I love Geelong Rainbow. They have been huge supports. There are other people in Geelong Rainbow with DID, which was such a huge deal for me. As a covert system, I sort of try to hide that I have DID because I don't want it to be a problem or distracting from me as I present myself. Which is K. I came into GR and there was already a person who was very out as having DID and everyone loves him. And it was so refreshing for my system to see that that's possible and also not feel so alienated. I don't need to alienate myself. I was able to straight up say, I also have DID, which is something that I don't do much. But yeah, GR has been, foundationally the reason why I'm able to even have this conversation with you about it now.
Yeah. And so there's an inclusivity that exists in the group that's very friendly with neurodivergence. With like the broad definition of neurodivergence, we fit into it.
And very divergent. Of course, trans people.
Yeah. And yeah, so there's a lot of, I think, understanding when it comes to what we live through, but also something I said last year, and it's very much how I view ourselves, is we're a jigsaw puzzle. We're more than just DID, you know? People are multifaceted. The inclusivity of the space where neurodivergence, mental health is normalized makes it a really safe space for people, for us, basically. Until you found this community space, did you notice, like, has the community space helped you with your journey of mental health?
So much.
Yeah.
I was sort of, after a bit, I shut myself in, had a bad experience with sharing my diagnosis with someone and them sort of using it against me. So that reinforced the idea of being covert, which to me at the time looked like not leaving my room and sort of just avoiding any situation that might trigger a switch, which meant I was stifling down my system, which is not good for our communication. It's not good for healing just generally. But yeah, when I found GR, I had a reason to get up and leave the house. And I just kept, they just kept giving me reasons. So, and they won't stop.
That's good.
But yeah, I definitely have become a happier system. Just in doing something that I care about. Can I talk about like what it's been like in like the, hospital?
Have you been in hospital?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, please, share.
There's kind of a lot of things that are coming up to the fore at the moment as well, particularly in terms of the way that we imagine, for example, essential work and also sort of essential community life or essential caregiving, and how those function. If we think about sort of the way that queer family often takes very, very sort of different forms and very, you know, important and meaningful forms that often don't match the picture of normative, heteronormative family life. But how so many of the affordances or the restrictions or the kind of the governmental sort of imagining of the way that we should live and what we need to live and what we need to survive really is shaped around heteronormativity. You know, it's around the family life in the suburb, as opposed to many you know, single individuals who have shared queer family, both sexual and community connections that sustain them and that kind of give them life and give them sort of energy and comfort and safety and security and support.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
And you're listening to 3CR Community Radio's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day's broadcast. For our final interview on navigating medical systems with DID, we chat to Jocasta.
I go by Jocasta Suzanne, or that's the name that I go by in my publishing work, as well as like to most people that know me. I've gone by other names in the past. Names that I'm not particularly like ashamed of going by, but it's always peculiar when someone like introduces themselves to me and calls me like, say, Josie or Jocelyn. I write poetry. Well, I write mostly poetry. I also write essays as well as short fiction. Those are the things that like I devote most of my time to. In terms of what it is like, I would say that it is very polyphonic in so far as
multiple voices. Yeah.
Yes, like there is a sort of an emphasis and an interest in the ways that a text can hold many voices and different styles and how like the sort of textual and discursive sense of language is kind of like dependent on a level of nonsense at its basic level. You know, which I think is probably most obvious in poetry, where like the literal semantic sense of language is, I don't want to say subordinated, but it is like irreparably modified by just the non-semantic or extra-semantic qualities of language, like rhyming, like assonance, which is like, you know, like vowels sounding good together with the repetition of certain sounds, the punning, and just however many different things that language does, either intentionally or accidentally, which kind of like modifies and complicates the sense of the communicative sense that we would hope to convey, and that is kind of the expectation of like spoken language when we're just having a conversation like this, for example.
What are some experiences you've had where you felt understood and there was space given to you both in time and to be like to get through what you needed to say, or has there not been that? You know, I'd be curious to know.
Well, it feels so the first it's a good question because it allows us to talk very directly about different sort of, you know, experiences that we've had and sort of comparison to make points. So like in retrospect, one of the first times that we started manifesting plurality or sort of disassociating in this kind of way was in 2016, we want to say, in the middle of 2016. We had just gotten out of an abusive relationship and we had to go back to Sydney and we were living with our parents at the time because we were essentially kind of catatonic. Like we were just, we couldn't function. And we remember being sent to a specific psychiatrist because according to the other person that we were seeing at that time, that we were, according to them, sort of exhibiting symptoms possibly of schizophrenia. When we were talking about like, we were talking about how there were specific like entities that we were sharing our thoughts with and that we were kind of such that like there were, and at the time it, we were thinking in terms of singularity and in terms of like us or me as a discrete individual. So that's the language that I'm going to use. So there was like me, I, and then there was like this other entity or this sort of not I. And in the middle, there was a kind of, you know, Venn diagram overlap of our shared thoughts versus like the thoughts of the entity and the thoughts of me at the time. And we went to see someone and they ascertained pretty quickly that we weren't schizophrenic, or according to whatever criteria that they were using.
Yeah.
We did not meet the diagnostic. And as a result, they kind of dismissed us quite quickly. And it wasn't, it was very kind of like cut and dry.
Tick box or don't tick box.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Let's not explore what might be going on.
Yeah. And it wasn't until, we want to say the better part of 7 years later, that we actually talked to someone. We can't remember the specific kind of psychotherapeutic sort of practice of theirs, but the idea was that, and we were seeing them for completely a different reason. We were seeing them just because we needed a therapist at the time, and a friend recommended her to us. And we spoke to this person, and the style of conversation was that we remember she would sort of have two chairs in her office, and based on the sort of conflicting voices that we were sort of feeling at the time and making sense of in our own way, like, she would direct us to one of the chairs for that voice and another chairs for that voice.
Yeah.
And so very sort of soon distinct kind of like, we don't want to say personalities, because that feels too anthropomorphic in some sense.
It's also the most stigmatized word around our disorder, because we were originally known as people with multiple personalities.
Yeah.
And we now know it's a dissociative disorder, not a personality disorder.
Yeah, yeah. And also, as we said, personality feels too anthropomorphic. It takes for granted the sort of dissociative element, or sort of like the element of sort of ambiguity that comes, it feels, with a dissociative identity disorder, which is that fundamentally there is the idea of a personhood or a person is suspect to a certain extent, or at the very least is not integral in the way that when we talk about an individual or we talk about a person in regular parlance, we just take it for granted that there is a discrete individual here in the world which we can point at and say, yes, that is a person. That is a fully consistent, or, you know, more or less consistent person that we can point at and say, yes, you. And that's not been our experience, because, like, certain of our alters aren't even people.
Yeah, I've got two alters. That one I mentioned before, Annie, she's really protective, and sometimes she's a magpie.
Very good.
And I got another alter who is sort of complicated. I know some people use labels, like classifications for different alters, and that's helpful.
In terms of like a defensive alter,
it's like sort of based in schema therapy. It's sort of like, this is the gatekeeper, this is that. For us, it doesn't really resonate. Like, it's not helpful for us. It might be for other people. But what we find, like, with this other one, Fetch is a young boy, holds certain memories, but also sometimes a wolf, and Fetch can be quite emotionless in order to survive some bad situations, pretty cold, and to get through things. And you mentioned two things. You mentioned something, and
we also have an alter like that. Yeah. Her name is Laika.
Yeah.
And she doesn't speak.
Yeah. And Fetch, going back to schizophrenia, we keep getting people thinking that we have schizophrenia, even when we tell them, no, we have DID, we've been diagnosed with DID, we know that this is what we have, it feels right. So when we were trying to work out what was the best trauma treatment for me with the public service, initially they wanted to send me to like hearing voices groups and stuff, and that's not what we're having. We don't externally hear voices. We have like a fragmented sense of self, a dissociative like states of self. We don't have this psychosis related, or I'm not an expert on schizophrenia, but related hallucinations of voices. But that just was like a reflection that like the skill set was not there.
For sure.
And then with Fetch, we told, there was a, back when, a while ago when we were seeing, there was a psychiatrist who Also, this psychiatrist just didn't believe we had DID. They just wanted to say we had BPD, and was like, no, we have. That's happened to us twice. But this was when I was sort of committed to this sort of outpatient program to to watch me, because I was considered like a danger to myself, and I was. And I was telling them a bit about Fetch, and as soon as they heard like the characterization of the Fetch being cold and stuff, they then started asking us questions about whether we had a history in childhood torturing animals. And that almost made us like want to cry. Yeah. It was so distressing to have someone think that we were like a sociopath or something just because we had an altar. And Fetch is not like exclusively, Fetch is not exclusively an altar that is emotionless. It's just one of the mechanisms, one of the defenses Fetch uses is to be cold. Mm. But it doesn't mean Fetch doesn't have feelings.
No, for sure.
Yeah. And so it's just, it's just one of those things where it's just, you mentioned it, and I'm just throwing two examples I've had with the systems.
And it's a conventional image that has persisted. Again, it's like, it strikes us as something very common to demonize people with DID.
Yeah.
You know, that they are sort of violent and aberrant in this kind of like almost cliched kind of way.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you've experienced that you think is interesting? Have you had any positive experiences with therapy or?
Well, like this person, the person I was talking about latterly. Yeah, that was a very positive experience.
Yeah.
Like it was the first experience we had in splitting in a way that we were aware of what was happening and we were able to articulate what was happening between us. Like we were able to hold conversations between the various parts of ourselves and, you know, the various kind of like, it allowed us to kind of articulate the fragmentation and also like sort of, you know, come to terms with it in one form or another. You know, whether that is like integration or whether that is in another form entirely. Like at the moment, in the kind of way that we go about our regular, the kind of way that we go about our daily life at the moment is that I, the one who is talking here, I front and for everyone and sort of speak in chorus, as we call it. So it's like we're all in a sense talking through this particular altar, you know, maybe some of us are harmonizing, some of us are like producing somewhat dissonant notes.
Yeah.
But the overall effect is we are speaking in chorus. Now, there is a kind of like unity of effect that is coming through.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You're so poetic. Obviously, you're a poet, but it's just like a very poetic way of putting it that resonates very true. If someone in the professions of mental health is listening, they could be a social worker, they could be a therapist or something. What advice would you give them if they encountered a patient who they thought had DID or the patient actually just told them, I have DID? What would you want them to, like, how would you want them to treat you?
God, on the one hand, we feel completely, you know, on the one hand, we don't feel qualified to offer any kind of medical advice.
Let's challenge that system of authority. Yes.
No,
and,
we understand. Yeah, no, it is a knee-jerk reaction on our part. Yeah. We would say take them at their word.
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing that we sort of brushed on earlier, but we didn't get to elaborate, that, like, the way that diagnosis and the way that, like, medical systems work is they produce the illusion that this is natural in a certain sense, whereas these are socially constructed and created kind of effects as a result of living in the world and society that we do.
Yeah.
It is not something that is like happening in a body it is not primarily or exclusively something that is happening in a body, in a brain, in a nervous system. It is also something that is happening in language. It is something that is happening in the way that we produce and create meaning in the world, you know? And because the world that we live in is one that is sort of inherently contradictory in certain regards, it means that the way that we use language is predicated on like an idea of wholeness that doesn't actually exist, and when it does exist can only produce kind of like pathological effects. And as a result, it becomes very difficult to, and as a result, it produces a sort of image that, and maybe it's more clear because of it's more clear, and it takes its grounding from, like, you know, physical medical science, because in the example of a body right there with organs and, you know, tissue and various different sort of definable and empirical like things that you can see there and say, okay, well, this is the tibia and this is like the ribs, and if we do this and that, then it's going to have obvious physical effects. Like, that is something that you can see and manipulate and go, yes, that is, like, there is some level of certainty there that we can say. And when that is applied, or that sort of a impression is implied to, applied to mental health, obviously there is something that is lost in translation, because, you know, the mind is not the body. Well, that's a whole fucking can of worms. But, you know, the mind does not get sick in the way that a body gets sick, necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, they are interrelated, and they are very sort of like, and they have interesting sort of effects in themselves.
Yeah.
You know? And treating the mind in this kind of deterministic kind of medical way is something that, like, flattens a lot of the experiences and a lot of, like, the symptoms that are important to pay attention to when it comes to conceptualizing what mental health even is. And so in that case, we would say, take them at their word. Like, listen to how they are producing meaning. There was a book, we read a while ago. We think it was some kind of, like, it might have been Anti-Oedipus by Deleuze and Guattari, who are, like, French philosophers and psychotherapists from the 70s. And they were talking about how the cliche back in, you know, like, the 60s and 70s, when psychoanalysis, for example, was more well-regarded and was seen as more, like, the same way that people still think of psychology and, like, talk therapy as someone sitting on their couch and a doctor being like, well, tell me about your mother.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the idea there, and so the idea was that they said that, like, the common image of therapy is, like, you go in and a doctor sort of listens to what you're saying and they go, well, based on X, Y, and Z, obviously you're talking about your mother or your father, or you're talking about your family history or your trauma or something like that.
Yeah.
And, like, they were talking about it in regards to schizophrenia in particular.
Yeah.
And they were saying that as it happens, you know, someone may be able, you know, a patient in this case may agree with them, may say, like, yeah, sure, you know, that's my doctor, that, you know, this whole, I might have my own cosmology that I've created as a part of my condition. And sure, it could be reducible to these, like, set characteristics of the mother, the father, etc., etc., you know, all the cliches. But also, like, when they try and explain it and when they sort of process it in their own language, eventually their own cosmology and their own sort of creations seep back into the diagnostic language and the language that the professional is using in order to make sense of their condition and sort of, like, produce a quote unquote cure.
Yeah.
And, like, that is not a failure. That is not a something that is to be avoided. It is something to be observed and is something to be engaged with.
That concludes 3CR Community Radio's Dissociative Identity Awareness Day's 2026 broadcast. You've just heard interviews with myself, Jack, Kay, and Jocasta on their experience of navigating medical systems with complex trauma and dissociative identity disorder. Before then, we heard me, Amy, in conversation with Kathy Kesselman of the Blue Knot Foundation. I would like to thank all my guests for their time and support. The last three interviews are actually about 30 to 40 minutes each, so I had to cut them down to fit into our time slot, but luckily for you, you can listen to those interviews in full at 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026. Also, please check out blueknot.org.au to learn more about complex trauma and dissociation, or call their number at 1300 657
380 if you need support. Big thanks to 3CR and Uncle Taljum for allowing us to use this time slot to make this broadcast. And of course, thank you, the listener, for tuning in. That's it from us. Stay tuned for more Radical Radio here on 3CR 855 AM.